This is a Collider.com audio interview.
It was like a more adult.
Well, no, I wouldn't say it's uber adult, and you're asking me about the tone. I think we have a little bit more fun than Twilight. I mean, Kevin Durant, our Mogadorian commander, is a really bizarre. He's sort of, imagine Christopher Walken as an alien. So he's a lot of fun. I think our tone is a little bit more. I think we have a little bit more fun in our action sequences. Helped designed by Brad Allen, who did, I don't know if you guys saw Kick-Ass.
Yes.
But he did designed a lot of the action in Kick-Ass, which I just love. So our action sequences have, I don't want to say a sense of humor, but we really have fun with sort of the powers that these kids have in a different way.
Like what kind of powers? Like what makes them different?
Well, we've got, you know, what happens is each one of these nine have acquired different powers. Number four has some, he discovers he has this lumen power that kind of sort of this light and energy that comes out of his hands. He has no idea what he's supposed to do with it or how to use it. He also has a little bit of telekinetic things that are happening. At the same time, he's got a little bit extra strength and speed. Number six comes in, and she sort of is, in the book, she disappears. We kind of made it more of a teleportation, and that's how she uses her fights and uses that to get away and do some things. She's also, I don't want to say like, and she has incredible speed. So all of the nine have different elements and different things that if you put these nine together, even though three have already been killed, you'd sort of have the
perfect, form a giant robot.
Yes, yeah, so you'd have a perfect fighting machine. Exactly.
How'd you come to choose Alex? What about him in particular?
You know what I liked about Alex was that there was sort of this sort of good-looking dynamic quality that he had, but at the same time he's really vulnerable, and that was really important to me because. You know, as a person, he appears to be outwardly really confident, but there's definitely something in there that just kind of makes him, I don't want to say he lacks confidence, but there's a vulnerability in there, and I always think if you can find that combination, and he also has a great physical prowess with that vulnerability, that was really important for me. So we read a lot of guys, but he ended up being the guy that was the best.
I don't think you've ever done an adaptation before, and it's kind of strange you're doing an adaptation before the book actually comes out and people actually read it.
Actually, it is weird, yeah.
So, I mean how do you make a movie with that? Like, no, you just kind of make the movie and just figure that the book and the movie are going to be separate, or you kind of...
Well, you know, I just thought, like, selfishly, you have to be really as loyal as you can, but you have to make a great movie. My job is to make a great movie. Try to make a great movie. And so what I was trying to do is figure out the characters in the adaptation and worked with a lot of different screenwriters, and you know, we're fairly true to it. It's not like we sort of dove off the deep end, but... You know, what's interesting, too, when you know that this is the first book and they've already, the second book's halfway done and they've outlined the third, some of the character decisions you're making in the first one might not blend with something that's going to happen later.
All
so,
right.
But I really was, that's why I think we kind of dealt, what we did was dealt a lot less with the history of where he came from and how he got here and dealt more with his life now on Earth. And I think if this ever is fortunate enough to continue on as a movie series, they're probably going to have to get back and go back and give you a little bit more history of how who he is and how he got here.
Is there anything you've been doing in the movie that they've been wanting to try to use for the book? Is there anything that's kind of carrying back over to them? Or?
No, I mean, it didn't seem that way, but it was just interesting in talking and trying to figure things out and sort of some of the ideas we had were interesting because I think as they started to plot the plots for the next books, we kind of spawned some good ideas for them to kind of follow. But there wasn't anything that, you know, there's certain elements or certain physical elements. There's this great box that came from Lorien and it does certain things and sort of opens up and gives you a history into when Alex is trying to figure out who he is and where he came from. It kind of does something like that. And there's certain weaponry that kind of came from Lorien, and the Mogadorians have these certain blasters, and there's a, I don't want to say, there's an ashing element to when a Mogadorian or a Lorien dies here on Earth, their bodies sort of eviscerate, and there's some cool things, and that's all kind of in the book, and keeping with all that sort of, I guess, mythology. It's been kind of fun.
I'm curious about the 3D or lack of 3D on this film, and what was the motivation for which?
You know, I think at the end of the day, we're not that big of a movie, if that makes any sense. Like, we're in the middle, and so I don't know. We never really got into 3D discussions. Steven and Mike, I think Michael, I've only just read about it. I know Michael hates it, but now I think he's ultimately doing it, right? and I don't know. I think this has just felt like it's kind of an old-fashioned... What I think, for me, it was like to try to ground this movie in the most realistic, you know, reality sort of way and make all of his emotions real and human. In the 3D element and the scope of the movie I could be quite honest, the discussions never even came up.
So what's your feeling, though, on this whole post-production thing?
Well, I think there's two ways, because having friends and the whole Eagle Eye crew was the crew that did Alice in Wonderland. And I know I was talking to Derek Wolski when they were making that decision, and they didn't shoot it in 3D, but they did the 3D sort of conversion, and they did it the right way. I mean, they spent the time and they took 18 months and they did it right. And then you go out and you see sort of Clash of the Titans that did it in a week and a half. And I'm not sure, from what I've heard about The Last Airbender, it sounds like it was pretty disappointing conversion, and it sounded really muddy, and just for, and I've just read about it. So I think there's, you know, either you do it, you shoot it in 3D, and Cameron designed his whole world that way, or now I think there's a lot of 3D conversions that are just happening because it sounds sexy to be in 3D, and it's not necessarily the best thing for the movie. But I'm seeing a great 3D movie, and, you know, I saw Toy Story in 3D, and I think it was the best movie I've seen in a long time. I'm all for it. I mean, I just it's weird. It never came up in any of our conversations.
Getting back to, like, the John and Henry's relationship, when we find them, they're already on Earth. How long have they been on Earth?
They've been on Earth, I think it's been almost 11 years.
Okay, and I talked to Timothy about some of this. He was talking about where there's a father-son relationship, even though he's, like, their guardian. And then right. He even went so far as to say it's almost like a father-coach relationship, which makes it a little bit more difficult. Do we see some of that, or are they kind of already settled?
No, they haven't said. I think you're sort of still in it. It's interesting, because I think ultimately John is looking for a father figure, and Henry is not quite that guy. He's not mature enough, and so Henry's trying to sort of be the father, but we kind of came up with the coach relationship about trying to sort of to be a teacher, to really be a teacher, and to do it in a way that sort of, you have to remember that the ways that they deal with each other and the way that they deal down here on Earth are not quite as it's not as normal, but it's just basically honing, keeping him focused and understanding. And part of Timothy's frustration as a character is that he's been told that you have to take this kid down, you have to guard this kid, and none of his powers or legacies have kicked in these 11 years that he's been down there. Finally, when the movie takes place, the first legacy kicks in, so some of his frustration is sort of, released.
You mentioned this wasn't a big movie, and I remember when you did Eagle Eye, that was like a really big thing for you to do, all these huge action scenes. So, I mean, why did you feel the want to step back and kind of go back?
It wasn't really a step back. It just, like, the way the movie kind of fell into place. It just felt like this... it's a tough movie to make, but it just felt like I wanted to make a cool science fiction movie with a character that sort of with a character that I really liked, and it was a movie about identity. I never really thought about bigger, smaller, bigger. Eagle Eye just ended up, it was a big movie. It was just a big movie, and I knew it was a big movie. This, when I say small, I mean, look, in the mid-50s of a budget is not a small movie, but nowadays for a movie and the expectations of the movie, It's not a huge movie, but I never really look at size or scope. It just, if I'm moved by the story, if I love the main character, then I'll be interested.
It's very different though, because you figure, someone like Michael Bay.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you can't see him go. He says he wants to go back to it, do a small movie.
Right.
But you can't see it because you figure it'd be like, it'd be hard to.
Well, I think it'd be hard because I think Eagle Eye was the first time I sort of might have bordered on spectacle, like the action and the element, and I felt like we were making this really great sort of video game that once you hopped on you couldn't get off. But I don't know, it'd be interesting to see. I think there's a certain kind of film, Michael Bay does spectacles so well, and I don't know if this is true or not, but there was remember years ago when they made Joel Schumacher made the movie Phone Booth?
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah.
Wasn't Michael Bay going to do that, and it turned into become like a $75 million movie? Right, or something. Right.
I heard something like that.
I don't know, it just might be in his DNA. It's in his DNA to make big spectacle movies. I'm hoping that I can jump around.
You mentioned last night you were still going to be a little challenged by finding the right tone between action, characters. You were talking about it last night. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about the challenges of...
Well, I think the challenges are, when you basically have some really strong, heavily dramatic scenes between Timothy and Alex, and at the same time, even tonight, if you guys are sticking around, which you'll see, we have a scene where Teresa Palmer comes in and looks incredibly sexy, and she's an amazing fighter, and she's teleporting and transporting and doing all these things and basically killing the aliens, these Mogadorians. And so when you, as a filmmaker, take a giant step back and you see that scene tonight that we're shooting and some of the dramatic scenes that we've shot, you always fear for tone. And it was one of the fears I had in Disturbia when we had our first test screening, and I'll never forget sitting there and, like, I never thought the movie was funny. It's weird, because you're making kind of a thriller and you have this character, and we're watching the first 30 minutes of the movie with this test audience, and they were laughing and they were going crazy, and I was having a heart attack thinking, there's no way I'll be able to, like, scare them. There's no way. I mean, these people are having fun. They think they're watching a comedy. But what I realized was it made him more endearing. It made you care for him even more because you got to laugh with him and feel for him, and that ultimately at the end of the movie that you really got more involved because you get, and so I'm hoping that that's the case here. If that makes any sense, and as you blend these sort of different elements of the movie, that it all kind of comes in, but John is your anchor, and he's the one, number four, takes you through all this, and if you hang on to his belt, you'll experience all these different things, and that's that's kind of what I was alluding to yesterday. You know, you every once in a while when you step back and you look at the sequences individually, you get a little nervous.
But you enjoy, I mean, audience members enjoy unexpected twists that in directions that a movie goes.
I think so. But, you know, we've all seen movies, too, where we go the first half and the second half don't quite blend, or the tone is a little weird, or you realize, like, wait a minute, somehow this third act sequence is not blending in with everything else. It's really well done, but somehow it seems like you're on two different tones. And, you know, that's my job to sort of police that it doesn't happen, but, you know, it's always the fears, particularly when you have all these different sort of elements working.
It seems like with your first two films, Disturbia and Eagle Eye, I felt like sort of like a Hitchcockian references there. Obviously, Disturbia, Rear Window, North by Northwest with Eagle Eye. Mm-hmm. With this, what are you looking for inspiration?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I watched, obviously, it was easy to watch kind of Rebel Without a Cause, because when I read it, it had sort of that feel. And then, you know, a movie I really watched that sort of was bizarrely inspiring was Starman. I really, really watched Starman, and I was just watching the whole Jeff Bridges of it all, and I even put Karen Allen in this movie after I watched Starman, and she came in and did a cameo. But it was one of those elements about what's it like to be on this planet, what's it like to sort of fall in love with all the things that we take for granted, and I kind of dealt with that, and also even kind of watched The Grifters in a weird way, because Henry and John are two characters that are kind of disenfranchised. As soon as something goes wrong, they just pick up and leave. And that's part of who John is, which I always thought was really interesting, is you meet him in the beginning of the movie in Florida, and he's having a great time with his buddies, and he's at this party, and everything's going well, and he's talking to this girl, and then, bam, something goes wrong, and they could potentially find out where he is, and he and Henry just basically take all their stuff, throw it in the fire, and kind of move on, change their hair and dye their hair. So there's this really interesting sort of, for me, romantic element of this disenfranchised character. Yeah. But as far as inspiration, is like in a Hitchcockian way, I don't think there's a Hitchcockian one here, but... Those are the two or three movies that I sort of tapped into.
I'm curious, and maybe this is me just not paying attention enough. Yeah. Timothy Olyphant plays the guardian mentor of Alex's character.
Right.
There are eight other people on Earth.
Eight of these children that were sent down.
Do they all have guardians?
They all have guardians. They're called Seepins.
Ah, there we go. Right. And are there... Do we see in the film any of those other Seepins or guardians?
In this film, you do not. In the next series of books, you will. But basically, Timothy Olyphant plays Henry, and he's John's guardian. And the only other number you meet here is number 6, who actually comes out and finds number 4 because her Seepin, her guardian, has been killed. And what's interesting is number 6 is about 6 months ahead of number 4, whereas as far as, like, once her Seepin got killed, she's now hunting down the Mogadorians. Instead of them hunting her, she's trying to find them. And so she's aggressively trying to find number 4. And so her maturity and her level and her mastering of her powers is advanced because she lost her Seepin earlier than John. And so you don't see number 6 as Seepin, but you know that her Seepin has been killed.
So all 9 are alive in this movie, or
no? The movie opens and number 3 gets it.
So we talked about this a little bit.
And then you know that hence number 4 is next. So they have to be killed in order.
They have to be killed in order?
They have to be killed in order.
Okay. Yeah. So game of 9 ball.
Yeah, exactly. That's right, 9 ball, left five.
We talked about this a little bit, because in the book it says there's someone that's trying to get them all together. If 3 of them are dead, what's the point of getting them all together?
Well, because what you see when you get number 4 and number 6 together, and you can see the devastation, the havoc they can wreak, you understand that if you can get those other 6 together, that there's still a chance.
Their powers are all linked.
They're all linked, yeah. They're all different, but they using them together, they can be powerful.
But what happens if they're killed out of order? I mean, is
they
that
can't
even
be
possible?
Killed. Well, they can't be killed out of order. They can be killed out of order if, like 4 and 6 actually ultimately work together, or if they're in the same place, and they can be killed. But they can't be killed out of order. In this book, book 2 deals with finding number 5. In this book, we don't even deal with number 4. In the screenplay, we don't even deal with number 4.
Yeah, I'm confused if you don't... about how does it mean you can't be killed? Could you sort of describe?
Well, basically, ultimately, the curse that was sort of... These 9 children are all member of the Lorien Guard. And the Lorien Guard were sent down here in the sort of the way that the powers were separated. The Mogadorians know, Kevin Durant knows, as a Mogadorian commander, he has to kill these children in order to remove all their powers, or for the future of these powers to even exist anymore. It's sort of like, you know, I don't want to say the Last Airbender, but once they're all gone, they're all gone. And ultimately, we learn that number 3 in the beginning of this movie has been killed. Number 4 is next. When he kills number 3, he whispers, and they're sort of connected, and sort of, I don't, in this sort of ethereal kind of way. He whispers into number three's ear, and we don't know what he's saying until it hits number four, John, when he's in Florida, and an incident happens, and he basically sees that vision, and he knows that he's next.
Kevin Durant's race, so are they like a warring planet, or are they...
Basically, they're basically, the Magadorians are sort of like, you know, imagine the Genghis Khan, where they've started to take these planets and to tap all their resources and just to sort of take them over, and they're sort of that way, and they've taken over Lorien, and now basically what we now realize is Lorien and Earth are so similar that the Magadorians have their eyes set on Earth. As they come down, as he's down here searching this, he's reporting back, and now they know that Earth is going to be the next planet. So it's not just what's happened in Lorien, it's also eventually what's going to happen down here on Earth.
So are the Lorians sent here just to try to
The Lorians basically, in a way, it's almost, there's a Superman element to it where they just basically had to get them out while Lorien was being destroyed.
Just to live.
Just to live. And they said, what will happen is once they mature and their legacies kick in, when they get older, we need to get them back together. Hence, Sam's father, who John meets Sam and ends up, the reason Henry comes to Paradise, Ohio, is the man that was supposed to get these nine together. Was centered in the center of America.
So the scope of this can get even bigger.
It's much bigger. It's definitely, the third book definitely leaves Earth, and I think towards the end of the second book, as far as the outline I saw, it starts to. There's a ship in West Virginia where they all have to kind of get to.
Is there an idea of how many books there's supposed to be?
I don't know the answer to that. I think there's at least four, right?
Yeah, I think there's more. You've done so much, obviously, developing the story to adapt it. Mm-hmm. Do you feel proprietary with it?
My job is to make the best movie I can, and sometimes there's not been heavy conflicts, but some of the ideas I've had don't sort of go along with what's going, but I have to try to make the best movie, and sometimes that means you have to, the only thing I haven't dealt with was, and who knows how popular the book will or will not be, is that if it becomes really popular, I'm sure there's going to be people go, like, change that, or they didn't follow that, but I think it being in this situation, like I said, I can't worry about it. I have to just try to make the best movie from a character standpoint and what works in this one screenplay. And I think what's interesting, what we ended up doing was, I think it was just stripping out a lot of all the history and past that's in this book and kind of keeping that more of the, what I call the Chinatown mystery. You'll figure that out later, or maybe you don't even need to figure it out because you just know what the immediate problem. The immediate problem in this screenplay is number three is dead. I'm next. I don't have my powers yet. And I like it down here on Earth. I don't know what this greater calling is. So then ultimately it's about surviving. Once you survive this movie and get through it and understand now who your enemy is and you figure out who you are, he's sort of like Luke Skywalker. He knows what his calling is now. By the end of this movie, as he rides away, hopefully he knows who he is and what his calling is, and it has nothing to do with the life he thought he was going to live.
If it does well, do you want to do the sequel?
Oh, gosh.
I know you're in the middle and you're like...
No, maybe ask me on the last day of shooting. I'd say, of course.
You talked earlier about tone. And it sounds... I'm kind of coming to the deep end here because I literally wasn't here yesterday and I'm kind of just hearing the story as you're telling it. Mm-hmm. But it sounds to me like it's kind of a very dark tone. It's a very dark tone and very serious because there's all this like chance of getting killed.
When I say this stuff, but there's also... You have to understand there's a guy who walks down the street and he's got these weird feelings and he gets excited, and as he clenches his fist... telephone lights just start to explode, and he realizes, like, what the fuck is going on? Mm-hmm. Did I do that? And then he figures it out. So there's an element of discovery, and there's an element of fun, there's an element of falling in love, which is incredibly fun. And our love story isn't, and this is not a criticism, it's not angsty, it's not about, like, oh my god, he falls in love with this girl, and he loves her, and she loves him. And there's nothing that's coming really between them, there's some guy but it's a lot more, I don't want it to sound like it's incredibly dark, there's some dark elements, but there's a lot of fun out. There's a lot of fun.
Well, what question? I mean, does this character, because you just told us also about the number, you know, Lawrence. Right. So this Alex's character, does he actually know all this stuff, or is he kind of finding that out?
That's one of the different. In the book, in the opening, he knows everything.
Okay, he does. Okay.
In the movie, he figures it out about three quarters of the way through.
Okay, so basically, the people watching this movie. They don't want to know about it. I mean, all this stuff is supposed to be finding out as they watch the movie. I feel like I'm just kind of really kind of like, wow, there's a lot of stuff to know going into a movie.
Yeah, no, exactly. Okay. So no, you'll discover all that with him, which I think that was more. I think it's much more interesting.
Okay.
As opposed to knowing in the very first voiceover who he is, where he's from, what's happening.
Got it.
And I think in the screenplay, there's a little bit more of the discovery of the powers that haven't kicked in. And in the book, the powers are almost there from the get-go.
The Guardians' role,
they basically do not have any of these powers or elements. They would be kind of like this great sort of Navy SEAL. If they were on this Earth, they'd be like the Navy SEAL fighting force. They'd be a special forces.
Okay.
They were like Lorian special forces that were assigned and sort of ripped from their families and said, "Your job is to go down to Earth and to guard this person."
But not tell them about their power.
No, they basically say when it's time and the power starts to come in, it's your job to sort of tell them and sort of nurture them. The Sepians are not like these people that can, you know, do anything gooey with powers, but they can basically just say, here's what's going to happen. I don't know what. And the great thing is they don't know what powers these kids are going to get.
Oh, okay.
So there's a mystery to what. That's what I'm saying. I think part of Timothy's character's frustration is moving this kid around the country or moving him around North America and just trying to figure out, like, okay, when is this shit going to happen? Nothing's happened.
Did you say the Guardians don't have powers?
They don't have powers. They're just great fighters.
But I thought you said that Henry started to discover his powers.
No. John. I think Henry's great discovery. Henry's great discovery is when John actually
when
has
John
his powers.
Powers.
It's
okay,
like, thank God, I didn't waste 11 years of my life or leave my family, because Henry made a big sacrifice in leaving.
Okay.
He had no choice.
I want to spend a quick turnaround, because obviously having a movie coming out in February, it wouldn't seem that much because like it's July, but still, it's, for a movie.
No, it's really tough. It's weird. I think last President's Day, you guys, Brian, was so huge. There was three movies that were huge on President's Day.
Right. I remember it was like Percy Jackson was one.
Yeah, Percy. There was, and so
and Valentine's Day.
And
it was,
so,
like, it was insane.
Yeah, there was like, yeah, it was an insane day. And so everyone just sort of set their goal and their... And, you know, for me, so I was like, yeah, I can make it. Because, you know, if it's a good date for the movie, it's a good date. And, you know, it'll be tough. But I think what's interesting is, coming from the Stevens School now, is... You work really hard on all your action and visual effect sequences, and you have to lock them. Okay. You know, you just have to lock them and turn them over, as hard as that is.
There's a lot more CG than normal than you've normally done.
There's more CG than I've ever done.
Okay.
Ever done? Yeah. I mean, and Eagle Eye, we actually had a Reaper airplane, but we couldn't put a Reaper in the tunnel, so there was a CG plane, a little bit, and then the rest of Eagle Eye is just cable removal.
All right.
Literally, cable removal. This has two fully formed 3D. Characters that are beasts that have come down, the Mogadorians take down with them, and there's this huge fight with two 3D characters. That's the first for me.
Are you going to show anything at Comic-Con? Or are you going to Comic-Con?
I believe we're going to show something.
Have a presence there, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have a presence there, and I think we're working on some kind of teaser or something. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We
cool.
probably have to make last question, because he's got to go to work.
Guillermo del Toro is your DP. Yeah. What's it like working with him? Because he's obviously done amazing things with Guillermo del Toro.
I got to tell you, I was so fortunate, because I was looking for DP, because Derek Wolski was out doing Pirates already. I loved working with him, and Amir Mokri was out doing Transformers 3, and I worked with him, so I was looking, and then as The Hobbit just kind of kept pushing, I made a call, because I know I love Guillermo's work, and I think Hans Labyrinth is just, you can't make a movie better than that, in my opinion, and it was so beautiful, and then Guillermo just sort of, this was months and months ago, they pushed The Hobbit one more time, and then this window opened up, and I called him. And he's just like, yeah, I'd love to go to work. I'm sick of sitting here not doing anything. he does commercials all the time. And so it just worked out. The timing was just so great. And at the time we were going to finish, he's going to get a month off, and then he'd be going to New Zealand for 3 years. But obviously that didn't work out. But for me, it worked out great. And he's a genius. He's passionate. He's a partner. And he just, every day you go to work, he's just so inspiring, because he loves what he's doing. And we both have a love of film. Not the digital world. We just love film. And it's just great to share with him.
Great.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, DJ.
Oh, sorry.